You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and boy, Mike Papantonio has been doing some mind-boggling research and has dug out some amazing stuff. America's lawyer, Mike Papantonio, the attorney with Levin Papantonio, host of Ring of Fire Radio, ringoffireradio.com, the website. Hey, Pap, welcome back to the program.
Tom, how are you?
I'm great. So you have been looking into, apparently it's not just one company, it's like an industry, a disinformation industry?
Yeah, it is. You know, for a long time it was a mystery, Tom, on how and why members of the university scientific community would predictably surface to defend and even promote this promote so many consumer products that were causing horrible suffering, horrible deaths by the hundreds of thousands around the world. We just didn't know where was it coming from. Even attorneys prosecuting the cases against tobacco, the tobacco industry, which we did, and the asbestos industry, which we did, the manufacturers of wildly defect killer drugs, we didn't know where it was all coming from. It was hard to uncover the dark blood money connections between the killer product manufacturers and the disgusting, shameless, hustler scientists and doctors who wrote what appeared to be legitimate scientific literature. It was really just well-engineered lies. But they would destroy the documents. They would destroy the document trails. It became impossible, really, to find the information. It was always difficult to find the smoking gun documents. And now we found them that clearly showed scientific fraud. There's something called a fraud broker. This is what I would call a fraud broker, who hustles these shameless doctors to write medical and scientific articles that are pure lies. They're pure fantasy. But a document that emerged in this horrible case that we brought against DuPont, it was a case where thousands of residents in West Virginia and Ohio had contracted cancer ranging from prostate cancer to liver cancer to kidney cancer because DuPont had dumped thousands of gallons of a product called C8 into their drinking water, their rivers, into their landfills, and had directly exposed workers to the C8 poisons right on the job site where it was manufactured. There was zero question, Tom, zero question that DuPont knew all the cancer risks. In addition, they also knew that C8 had a connection to birth defects. The product was so bad that the product was so dangerous that 3M stopped manufacturing it totally. It's a product that's used in Teflon pans that you have when you cook in the morning, for example. So what DuPont did, and this is the same trail we're finding again and again now that we're learning more about how they do this. They hired what I call a biostitute broker. That biostitute broker creates these corporate engineered science studies that write fantasy science literature, just make it up sometime. They create knowingly false press releases, and they set out with a goal not only to convince legislators in the media and the medical community that the product is safe, that the product they're hustling is safe, but they go as far as trying to say it's genuinely good for the overall health of the consumer. That's their ultimate goal, whichever product they're working on. This week, for example, right in your backyard in Washington, D.C., I'm going to be taking the deposition of a man who helped engineer the fantasy fraud science plan for tobacco, the asbestos industry, manufacturers of Agent Orange, DES, FinFin, infant baby formula toxins, for God's sakes, and about a dozen more consumer products that have caused hundreds of thousands of deaths around the world. The name of the company is called the Weinberg Company, and they work right there in your backyard in Washington, D.C. There's only a few companies in the world that do this. Weinberg is known as the master of it. And now we're finding documents where Weinberg is writing to people like DuPont, and we're saying, here's what we can do for you. Right. We can create this fantasy trail, and we can protect your income stream by, you know, a whole host of different things that they do. But it's the ugliest story. I've been doing this for 30 years. This story, to me, is the ugliest. To have this character that I'm going to be deposing has been doing this. He was like the number three or four company for the Weinberg company. And he knew what he was doing when he was trying to make children believe that secondhand smoke wouldn't hurt them or that cigarettes wouldn't hurt them. He knew what he was doing when he was telling women that FinFin was safe, when his scientists were writing articles that FinFin was safe or that DES was safe or that Agent Orange was safe. He makes no distinction on who he goes after. It can be children on infant formula. It can be the soldiers who were poisoned by Agent Orange. So he's going to have a bad day Friday, a bad, bad day in Washington, D.C. when I take this deposition.
Wow. First of all, Weinberg Group, any relation to Casper?
No, I don't think so. Okay. Although I will ask the question. Yeah. We're going to find a lot. The reason this deposition is so important, Tom, is we start uncovering the pattern of how do we find, not for just Weinberg, but how do these companies create this false science? How do they create a false science that, for example, climate change is not real? How do they do that? How do they create this fantasy science that fracking is completely safe? They go to companies like Weinberg who simply spread money around. They simply talk to some scientist working at a university and say, you know, how would you like to make another $100,000 this year? All you have to do is write an article. We'll write it for you. As a matter of fact, Mr. Scientist, we'll write it for you. All you have to do is sign it. And the medical community doesn't know what's going on. This company, Weinberg, was investigated by Congress, as a matter of fact. They called them in and they said, you have some explaining to do. They called them in about something called PFO, which has to do with, well, it has to do with the C8 issue that we're talking about. But they wanted to know their history. What, you're bragging, they found Weinberg bragging on the internet about how they could change science by hiring these scientists that would say basically exactly what the company wanted. And it didn't have anything to do with the truth. Didn't have anything to do with thousands of people's lives being put at risk here. Weinberg was willing to do this knowing, for example, they took on, for example, Tom, they took on secondhand smoking as they set out to defend secondhand smoking to convince the American public there was no danger to secondhand smoking after just hundreds of thousands of people have died from smoking.
Do they run ads on Craigslist that say things like, you know, well-paid sociopath wanted?
Well, you know what? I'll tell you something. By the time Friday is over, we're going to know a lot more about Weinberg, and we're going to be doing a lot more expose on the companies like Weinberg. The fellow that I'm taking on Friday broke off from Weinberg. He started his own company, I'm sure doing the same type of thing. But there's an MO. And what has to happen is Congress has got to say, you know, when you do this kind of thing, we're not just going to call you in front of Congress and ask you some questions. We're going to do something a lot more punitive to that than that. For the university who participates in this fraud science, saying that smoking is safe or asbestos won't hurt you or FinFin is safe or DES is safe or Agent Orange is safe. We're gonna do more. Congress has got to get involved in stopping these shills, these fraudulent shills that are out there working not only to destroy science, but to kill consumers, knowingly kill consumers. That's what's happening here.
Wow. And, you know, what's astounding is they've apparently been doing this for years and nobody has had a crisis of conscience.
Well, that's exactly right. The guy that I'll be deposing on Friday has been doing this his entire, you know, career. He started off with Weinberg as the number four company. He knew when he was trying to find, he brags about the companies that he's worked for. He brags about the fact that he was the guy behind DES. He was the guy behind Agent Orange that killed thousands and thousands, harmed thousands of our troops.
Wow.
Bragging about things like that. So yes, this is widespread. We're going to find out more about
something
it.
Something really, really wrong with this. America's lawyer, Mike Papantonio, you're doing great. You're doing God's work, Pap. Thanks so much for dropping by and sharing it with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Keep it up. And you can learn all about it. You can listen to a past radio show on the weekends, ringoffireradio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
That's ringoffireradio.com. There's a link on our homepage to it, tomhartman.com. And welcome back, Mr. Papantonio.
Tom, how are you?
Good. So this weekend here on Free Speech TV, you've got Ring of Fire TV coming up.
Well, we've got a great show lined up. I've got David Haynes. He's going to talk about the very latest and the newest suppression efforts by the GOP. What's happened is they've been given the right to suppress votes now state by state since the U.S. Supreme Court just gutted the right to be able to protect people against against this type of thing. We're going to have Richard Eskow talking about the host of the Zero Hour. You have him on your show often. He's brilliant, brilliant man. And he's going to talk about how the Democrats simply are such a failure in understanding what the theme should be going into an election like the midterms. Michael Berg's going to talk about the resurgent labor movement that's taken place in America. It's not organized labor. It's fast food workers. It's a labor movement that might have some impact if we'll keep it up. Attorney Anne Marie Murphy is going to talk about California's new proposition to reverse the tort reform that is killing them literally in California, where doctors, no matter how bad the malpractice is, they can cut off a leg, they can blind you, they can do whatever they need to do to get out of that surgery room, and they're right now responsible for $250,000, no matter how bad the conduct is. Howard Nations is going to talk about how everything in the South, from the environment to mobility for people in the South, is just going down the tubes, and why it's going down the tubes.
Wow. That's a lot of good stuff.
Good show.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think to me, I was very moved by this Anne Marie Murphy discussion about what's happening in California. You may recall that when Karl Rove started his tort reform movement in the United States, it was done so he could dry up money from lawyers to the Democratic Party. He actually wrote a paper describing why he was doing that. And in the process, you had states that where the media was pathetic. The media rarely understood the issue. And they were reporting that if you'll give up your rights to sue a doctor if he cuts off the wrong leg, or if you'll limit your rights to $150,000 or $200,000, then insurance rates for everybody are going to go down. And there'll be more doctors that'll stay in town. Well, the states that did that, there not only has the insurance rates not gone down, they've gone up. Doctors, it hasn't changed a bit, not one iota, the number of doctors practicing medicine. But the media, again, was just so gullible. They're just so easily hustled, and they bought into this idea. So California finally woke up and said, you know, damn it, we're going to fight back. We know this is a fraud. The insurance industry brought this fraud about, and so we're going to change all that. They're going to make it to where a doctor operating in the operating room on a regular basis runs the risk of having a random drug check, a urine check, to find out whether he's on drugs, because they're having that problem nationally, especially in states where tort reform.
Yeah, you have more healthcare workers or primary care physicians. More of these folks are using drugs than the population as a whole.
Yeah, I didn't know that. That doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
It doesn't surprise me a bit. So this is an important movement throughout the country. Let's let California lead it.
Yeah, there you go. Mike Papantonio, America's attorney, America's lawyer, and the website ringoffireradio.com, although here on Free Speech TV every Sunday at noon Eastern time and throughout the week as it replays, it's Ring of Fire TV. Pap, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Always great talking with you. See you tonight on TV. We'll be back. Stuff that's going on in the world these days, and Mike Papantonio laying it out for us. Who could do this? I mean, who could possibly even work for a company like this? It's pretty shocking. It's pretty startling. Oh my! A lot of other things in the news today. Who's paying the pro-war pundits? Li Fang has been doing some amazing reporting on this. You see all these retired generals on TV, you know, saying, oh, yeah, we need to do this or that. We need this weapon system. We need that weapon system. You know, what Lee Fong writes is, what you won't learn from media coverage of ISIS is that many of these former Pentagon officials have skin in the game as paid directors and advisors to some of the largest military contractors in the world. And he tells the story, for example, of General Jack Keane, who's a Fox News military analyst. And, you know, I truly believe we need to put special operation forces in there. Left unsaid during his media appearances and left unmentioned in his congressional witness disclosure form are Keane's other gigs as special advisor to Academy, that's the company that we used to call Blackwater, as a board member to tank and aircraft manufacturer General Dynamics, as a venture partner to SPC Partners, an investment firm that partners with defense contractors, including Exvionics, and in an operation management decision support system company used in Air Force drone training. Oh, and by the way, he runs his own consulting firm, GSI LLC. Right. This is just one of them. I mean, you know, it just goes on and on. If you see Anthony Zinni, if you see a general on TV, Fran Townsend, former White House Homeland Security Advisor, you see one of these people on TV, odds are they're double dipping. How can you do that? How can you go on TV it's amazing. Hillary Clinton has come out against Scottish independence. Uh-oh. Is that going to make the Scots vote for independence? I don't know. I really have no sense of how she is perceived in Scotland. This is from an article John Nichols wrote, I believe, at The Nation. Yeah, at thenation.com. He says, it is true up to a point that Scottish independence would create complications for the United States. Independent Scotland could, for example, demand the removal of British Trident missiles, which are carried on submarines that are based in Scotland. You know, here's the thing. If Scotland is going to do this, and you mark my words, if Scotland doesn't vote for independence, okay, things continue the way they are. And odds are that's probably what's going to happen. If they do vote for independence and they don't create their own currency, it's going to be a disaster. If they do vote for independence and they do create their own currency, Scotland is, you know, more progressive than the rest of England, than the rest of the United Kingdom. It is, generally speaking, it is better educated in many parts, in many cases. And, you know, it really is a culture apart. I think if they simply got control of their own money, they could go a long way. So, the whip count. This just a couple of interesting stories here. Oh, Reaganomics. I was looking for. Oh, what was it? The change in tax rates. Yeah, I was looking for some simple graphic that had to do with Reaganomics the other day, and I stumbled across the Reaganomics Wikipedia page. And, Shane, if you can pull up the clip of John Kennedy talking about how, in the 1960 debates, about how he was going to raise taxes. So the Kennedy-Nixon debate. And this is, you know, I've told you before the story of, you know, being in right-wing think tanks here in Washington, D.C., and seeing a whole bunch of computers all dialed into Wikipedia. And it's, you know, here they're talking about Reaganomics, and it says, before Reagan's election, supply-side policy was considered unconventional by the moderate wing of the Republican Party, though in reality, John F. Kennedy, in his 1963 State of the Union address, proposed substantial reduction in marginal tax rate, as well as in reduction in corporate tax rate. Yeah, but it wasn't Reaganomics. Say what? Oh, your computer froze. Okay. Well, I'll play the clip for you after the break. But, you know, the reality is that Jack Kennedy, I mean, go back to the Nixon-Kennedy debates. Jack Kennedy was basically saying, yeah, the top tax rate's 91%. Nobody pays that because, you know, over the years, over the last generation and a half or so, rich people and politicians and Republicans have drilled so many holes in the tax code. He said, let's tighten up the tax code. Let's do away with the loopholes so that people, you know, like Jack Kennedy himself, multi-millionaires, billionaires probably in today's dollars, actually start paying taxes. It was the opposite of Reaganomics. But don't tell that to Wikipedia. And, and a lot of these sources, they go back to books written by right-wingers or by right-wing think tanks. And, oh, yeah, hey, you know, it's in print, so it must be true. It's really quite remarkable. I keep finding this. I find this on stuff like Smoot-Hawley. I find this on History of the Great Depression. It's the very subtle right-wing hand.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And here's the tragedy. I mean, the right-wingers have the money and, you know, to just pay people to do this, left not so much. And all over America, there's high school kids who are using this stuff for their term papers. Tom Hartman here with you. Apple moving forward with their pay thing. This is interesting. They tokenized the payments, so it may well be far more secure than a credit card. The other day I was wondering out loud, you know, could this be, hey, an imitation to steal my iPhone? But, you know, maybe Apple's got this thing figured out. The banks are all scrambling right now, according to the Financial Times. To be the preferred card. Apparently, you pick one card and you say, okay, this is my main card. This is the one that, you know, usually comes up when I do things. And but you can have up to apparently 8. So we're still all learning this stuff. So time will tell. Time will tell how this all goes. Paul in Fairland, Oklahoma. Hey, Paul, thanks for calling the show. You wanted to talk about Republicans and Christianity?
That's Coklahoma, bought and paid for.
Coklahoma. There you go.
I'm a Cokie.
Uh-huh.
Really. Now, you know, back when Hitler took power, he told his inner circle that they had to strip the veneer off of Christianity and mold it to fit their party and their people.
Well, he established an official Christian state. Bishop Mueller was the guy's name who was put in charge of the official Protestant German church, and Bishop Mueller committed suicide right after the end of World War II.
And, you know, and if you look at the Republican Party, you know, everything is around Christianity, and I think that that's what they've done, is they've got these Christians in this country really deceived. You know, Hitler banned all abortions, too. He wanted Christianity taught in the schools.
Right.
But he molded it to fit his party.
Well, he also banned abortions because he wanted more Germans. I mean, you know, this was...
And you know, he blamed everything on the Jews, and then he convinced the Christians that it was their fault. They brought it on themselves.
Yeah.
And, that's just exactly how the Republican Party has. You know,
Paul, I think drawing parallels between today's Republican Party and the Nazis is weak. I really do.
Well, I don't mean... Actually, the party, I'm talking about their views on stuff.
Yeah, but, it does us better, I think, to simply point out that most Americans would like to strengthen Social Security rather than privatize it. The Republicans want to privatize
exactly.
it. The Democrats want to strengthen it. I mean,
You know, he banned all your trade unions and, you know, promised everybody work.
Yeah, it was the communists and the trade unionists, actually, that Hitler first went after.
Very cheap labor.
Yeah. Excellent point. Paul, thanks. Paul, I'm sorry. I've got a piece of dust here. It looked like Raul.
You're doing
Paul,
a great job.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Rob in Mountain Iron, Minnesota. Hey, Rob, what's up? It's ISIS?
Hey, Tom, can I be a little bit comical before I get serious?
Sure.
You've listened to Arlo Guthrie's Alice's Restaurant, have you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've listened to it when it first came out.
I mean, here I am standing in the middle of a hallway. All of a sudden, I need to pee, and the whole thing is where I need to go to the bathroom, and it comes down to a point where I got to go all the way downstairs, and I end up on a Group W bench.
Right.
Like you did the other day.
Oh. Yeah, really. Okay.
Anyway, ISA, it's where when it comes down to... the seeds of this whole thing going on in Iraq, it's where, let's face it, it's where W planted the seeds for what's going on right now. And the whole thing is where this problem will not be solved by more military power, I don't think. How about, what do you think?
I think that ISIS is by and large, something that we helped create. We created the circumstances and conditions for this. We broke two states, Afghanistan and Iraq, and in the process of breaking them, we destabilized the entire region, and we helped set up a government that was largely a Shia government that was disenfranchising Sunnis. And so you've got a bunch of really, really upset Sunnis who've got a 700-year-long grudge match going against the Shia. And ISIS is like the preeminent now Sunni fighting force slash, hey, we can be a government. And so you've got a lot of Sunnis who don't share their radical ideology, but say, hey, they're one of us. And they're joining up. And there's an op-ed in today's New York Times suggesting that maybe we should even cut a deal with Mr. Assad, Mr. Poison Gas.
Basically, it's where, the revolution that we had over here, it's where we imposed the government on Iraq, and the whole thing is where we forced out the Sunnis, Al-Paul Bremer, and the whole thing is these people are coming back to bite us in the butt.
Yeah, big time. I don't think that there are good parallels between the American Revolution and what's going on over there, but I think that, you know, if you want good parallels, look at what's happening right now in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Nicaragua as a result of Reagan and Ali North funneling millions and millions of dollars of illegal weapons into that region and supporting the death squads, you know, and people like John Negroponte going down there and helping organize, or at least so the stories go, helping organize death squads in El Salvador. And now the death squad, I mean, they're still with us. The people who were, who were so badly psychologically wounded and scarred by being the children of the death squads, or the children of the victims of the death squads in some cases, are now the brand, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. And again, you can take this back to Reagan. And with regard to the Middle East, Iraq, I mean, you know, Obama is the fourth president in a row to drop bombs on Iraq. I mean, at what point do we say, okay, already, it doesn't work? Excellent point, Rob. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Jerry in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Jerry, you wanted to talk about the Sunnis and war in the Middle East?
I want to talk about our allies in the Middle East. I think we've chosen the wrong side. Not that this war has any value, but the Saudis are people who have betrayed us, or a government that has betrayed us over and over again, from 9/11 to accepting or buying and nurturing our arms industry. The rest of the Sunnis in the Middle East have absolutely no value as allies. They have made an unholy alliance with Israel, which is hardly an ally when we ever go and get involved in anything. I would like to question why on earth we are rejecting the Iranians, the Persians, the Shiites in the Middle East when they are the only potent power who is reliable. Yeah. In fact, we have offended Iran in every way, shape, and form since 1953, when we overthrew Mossadegh and released BP to contaminate our Gulf. We overthrew that government, installed the Shah, who ran a brutal dictatorship until 1979. The only time they have ever lifted a finger against us was in the hostage crisis, and as I recall, they did not kill anybody in this hostage
crisis. No, they released all of them the moment that Ronald Reagan put his hand on the Bible to be sworn in January of 1981.
Exactly. There was a betrayal there by the Republicans to get Ronald Reagan in power, right. Which brings me just to a side issue of, as long as you call it Reaganomics, instead of calling it voodoo economics, which is what George Sr. called it, you are not going to make much progress with the American people, because Reagan somehow is still admired.
Yeah.
And when you change your lingo to the farce of supply side economics, and call it what it is, which is voodoo economics, you can make much better progress.
Yeah, I don't disagree with the labeling, but you know the fact of the matter is this is what they call it. I was just speaking to Wikipedia how incredibly skewed so many of these pieces are over on Wikipedia to the right. Here's what Jack Kennedy actually said he wanted to do. He did want to lower the top marginal tax rate, but not because of some Reaganomics supply-side fantasy that if you lower taxes, you increase revenue. What he wanted to do was close enough loopholes that he would actually get more money out of rich people. Here he is.
I think it's possible to gain a $700 million to $1 billion
gain
tax changes, which I believe would close up loopholes on dividend withholding, on expense accounts.
And then so he talks about how he'd use that money. Here he is.
So in my judgment, we would spend more money in this administration on aid to education. We'd spend more money on housing. We'd spend more money, and I hope more wisely, on defense than this administration has done. Mr. Nixon misstates my figures constantly, which is, of course, his right. But the fact of the matter is, here is where I stand, and I just want to have it on the public record.
Yeah, and now even Wikipedia has forgotten that. So, you know, it's amazing. I mean, you know, I think one of the quotes that came out of Nazi Germany, you know, he who controls history controls the present and the future. And there is the Reagan legacy project, which has been, you know, well funded and going on for 20 plus years, to basically rewrite all the history of Reagan and get him all these statues all over the place, name buildings after him and everything else. And it's not doing a service to this country. Jerry, thank you for the call. Thanks for your point. I think my main response to your point is that we don't have allies in the Middle East other than possibly Israel. By and large, what we have are interests, and we need to be reevaluating our interests.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And step one of that reevaluation is to release this 28-page report on who was funding 9/11, because I have a feeling we know who it was. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Julian, watching Free Speech TV in Snoqualmie, Washington.
Washington, really?
There you go. Hey, Julian, what's up?
Hey, how are you, man?
Good.
So, man, when is the troopers, all the military people coming back to the United States of America, when is this going to be done?
That's a good question. You know, we have troops all over the world. I think we've got, 170 military bases? Some mind-boggling
right.
Number. Yeah, more almost as many as there are countries in the world, and in some countries we have multiple military bases, Germany and Japan particularly. I think the troops will come back when there's a broad consensus in the United States that we're no longer an empire. This is what happened to the UK after World War I, and then you know far more aggressively after World War II. But after World War I, after World War II, rather, in the 1950s, you know, I think it was 56, England gave up their claim to Kenya and to Uganda, and a number of other you know colonial countries in that era, you know, in the 50s, and the consequence of that has been really good for England. You know, they're not paying to have empire, and to the extent that we have been paying to have empire, we used to pay to have empire to be able to have access to food, you know, to raw materials and resources, rubber plantations, our affiliations in the Far East, you know, in the Philippines and whatnot, and pineapple and bananas and things like that, you know, down in the Central American states and in Hawaii. Now our foreign policy, our affiliations have been driven by fossil fuels, and you know, for better or for worse.
So,
go ahead.
Can I say something real quick? Because this is what I don't understand.
Sure.
If America, the planet, the United States of America, now we love our country, correct?
Yeah.
We say we do, but we keep putting our hands and our noses where it doesn't need to belong. Why do we do this? And in America, people are dying in America. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
Why can't we just stop it? You know what I'm saying? Government, I mean, excuse me my language, but the government needs to back off and let America be and help each other forget putting their nose in every country. What's going on?
Did he just
on?
Say something that shouldn't be said on the air? Okay. Julian, I'm dropping your call. I'm sorry. I missed a word there, but it was apparently something that shouldn't go on the air, and Shane dumped it. So my apologies. My apologies. I got distracted for a minute. And our guest apparently he apologized. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, you know, if anybody was offended, my most sincere apologies. We will be back in just a minute. We're going to hit a break here any second, and we'll continue with your calls, the news of the day, my take on it, all that kind of thing. So, 5 seconds. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Here we go. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you, 10 minutes before the hour, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Emil, is it Emil in Newtown Square,
yeah.
Pennsylvania?
Yeah, Tom.
How are you? What's on your mind? You want to talk about the House of Representatives?
Yeah, the GOP has harmed all Americans. The House has to be controlled by Democrats. I'm going to read this. To save the United States, we have to have the Democrats control the House. I say all Democrat congressional candidates running have to present aggressive, truthful statements against their Republican opponents. And I have here, it'll take me a couple minutes to say, the following Republican involvement should be in every TV ad. And these are the things that should be in the ads. First, the post office forced to pay $7.5 billion per year to their pension fund. Two, they're anti-gay, opposing global warming, costing the world trillions of dollars.
Now, I get it. I can go through a long list of problems. How, you know, in the last election, Democrats got almost 1 million more votes than Republicans did for members of the House of Representatives. Yet the House of Representatives remains in the control of the Republicans, in large part because of the way that they've redistricted, they've jerry-rigged, gerrymandered all these congressional districts.
In Pennsylvania.
Do you have a solution for this? Because, you know,
if the Democratic candidates state, I have 26 points here. If they state these in their ads throughout the country, it'll make people more aware. The ones that are not strong Republicans may even consider voting against them.
Yeah, I think 26 is a lot. Bernie, when he was on Meet the Press over the weekend, you know, he basically said they want to privatize Social Security. They want to privatize Medicare. They want to, you know.
You've been talking about.
I'm with you, Emil. Thank you very much for the call. Liz in Portland. Hey, Liz, what's up?
John, how are you?
Good.
I'm not too happy because every day I wake up and there is a war machine going on. The television is a propaganda machine. I can't take much of it. The only thing I can think that will work is a tax revolt. We can't, when we get our taxes, it's not like we can check off boxes and say where we want our taxes to go. So the only way to do it is to, you know, for everyone not to pay their taxes.
No, the way to do it is to get as many people as you can to the polls in November.
No, voting doesn't work either, Tom. It's not working.
Well, it doesn't work if you don't vote.
No, it's not. It's not working. The Supreme Court just said that anyone they want to can give as much as they want to whoever they want to.
Right.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
The only way to do it is to fight fire with fire, take away their money.
But see, Liz, if you stop paying your taxes, they will put you in jail.
Offset the fiscal budget.
Liz, if you stop paying
and
your taxes...
You cannot possibly audit 100 million people.
No, and 100 million people aren't going to stop paying their taxes. And if you stop paying your taxes, they will put you in jail.
No, Tom, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that some type of tax revolt has happened.
The rich people are putting all their money overseas.
Passive protest is not working. There's protests every day.
Yeah.
And the voting is rigged. They're paying off these people. We can't even trust Democrats now to do what we do. I did not vote for Obama to go over there and bomb people more. Which is interesting that his name is Obama.
Yeah, Liz, I get it. Thanks a lot for the call. I'm just not into the circular campaign, circular firing squad today. I'm sorry. Charles in Opa-locka, Florida. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Well, I'm going to ask you a question. Aren't you a little bit disheartened to see you got three major networks today propagating war against ISIS? To me, it just seems like it's a campaign that's already started by the Republican Party. Hello?
Yeah, I'm listening.
Okay. You know, they've taken us from their main agenda, which are jobs, you know, which putting people back to work.
Right.
And getting this country back on its feet. You know, as far as imperialist country, I guess we still can be at the top of the food chain, because basically once we get back to work, once we can produce again, you know, there's no other country that has the resources and the workers that we have.
Yeah.
But basically, we're being stifled from this Congress that has, no matter what, there was famous picture, Truman holding up the sign, you know, that Dewey defeats Truman.
Right.
It can be done, America. All we have to do is put our heads to it, and we have to put our hearts into it as well, because they basically what they've done is part of what the Nazis did. They have taken control of the media, the Republican Party, the conservatives.
Yeah, let's stop the Nazi analogies, Charles. I mean, there's I forget whose rule it is, but there's a saying, you know, whoever invokes Hitler first loses the argument. We don't, you know, there are some Nazis in the United States. They don't have any political power. They're by and large cartoon characters. The Republican Party is not the Nazi Party. The Republican Party is, you know, they're shills for the billionaires and the big corporations. But they're not Nazis.
Okay, they're not Nazis. Okay. But, you know, they're basically treating America like a plantation, and I'm sorry.
Sure.
Okay, basically.
Sure. It's an extension of that mentality.
One of the best things that's come on this week, have you seen anything about the Roosevelt? There's a PBS documentary on the Roosevelt, so I suggest everyone take
a look. Yeah, Ken Burns' new piece. We've got to get Ken on this show and talk about it. I have not seen it. I was on an airplane Sunday when it was playing, but I heard that it was really, you know, the first hour of it was really good. And it's, what, 13 hours or something, some long thing? So it's going to run for quite some time.
Like where we live in history. Basically,
yeah.
Back in World War One again, when troops came back, there were no jobs, you know, when the military men came back. And that's why I saw that, you know, prohibition, as far as it took off, you know, the illegal stuff. And it seems like it's happening again. There's no jobs for these veterans coming back, so that's why I think we have to, why we're making cannabis, you know, legal in some states.
Well, the main thing was, you know, you had all these GIs coming back after World War II, and so FDR said, well, you know, we can't put them in the workforce, there's not that many jobs, let's send them to college. And that worked out actually quite well.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Lee Fong is on the line with us, investigative reporter for The Nation and The Republic Report, republicreport.com, thenation.com. And Lee, welcome.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
It is always great having you on the program. You've been doing some amazing reporting on the generals who are informing us on television. Do I have that right?
That's right, Tom. In a story we posted last Friday, we took a look at some of the most prominent pundits who are calling for a military solution to the ISIS issue. Most of these folks that we reported on are former generals, and they're introduced when they talk about these issues in the media as only former generals or current think tank heads. What hasn't been disclosed or acknowledged when these folks have gone on the media is their current positions in the defense contracting world. Many of these individuals are highly paid board members, advisors, or employees of defense contractors that would benefit from many of the policies that these individuals are pushing.
And these are names like Anthony Zinni, for example?
That's right. Anthony Zinni, Jack Keane, Jim Mattis. These are former generals that have been quoted in the print media or have gone on television saying that we need to deploy thousands of American soldiers to the region, that we need to arm various militant groups or governments in that region, that we generally need to step up with a military response of bombing and supplying more weapons to the region.
Why does the media put these guys on without any disclosure of their agenda?
Well, that's a good question, Tom. You know, I did my story building on the really great reporting of the New York Times in 2008. The Nation had a story several years ago. Kevin Connor, the really fabulous researcher. A lot of folks have actually looked into this issue and shown that for years, going back to the Iraq War and maybe even before that, major media outlets have brought on former generals, military folks, and refused to disclose their military contracting ties. So this is not a new issue. This is an ongoing issue. The networks know about it. But they've refused to disclose or identify some of these potential conflicts of interest.
Yeah. What does this mean for policy in the United States? To what extent have they been successful in influencing policy?
Well, let's just talk about one of the folks we reported on, Jack Keane. He's a former general, former advisor to General Petraeus. He's the Fox News military analyst. He's been going on primetime television almost every night in the last week and fairly frequently in the last 2 months, talking about a robust military solution for a very complicated political and sectarian issue. And, you know, he's a board member to General Dynamics. They make airplanes and tanks, tanks that are sold to Saudi Arabia and Iraq. He's a venture partner at a VC firm that invests in defense companies. He has his own consulting firm. And he's also an advisor to the company formerly known as Blackwater. So he has a lot of skin in the game, but he's going on television to a primetime audience. And remember, Fox News is much bigger than CNN or MSNBC. They have over 4 million primetime viewers. So he's talking to a large audience, and in many cases, he's the only military expert brought on to talk about these issues. So it's really a disservice to the viewer that they're only getting one point of view, and that point of view is severely conflicted.
There is, to the best of my knowledge, correct me if I'm wrong, there are no businesses that are highly profitable, particularly with government contracts, that could afford to throw $250,000 or $500,000 or $1 million a year at some former general to advocate peace. Are there?
That's a great point because, you know, if you look at some of the largest public policy debates in America, they're often determined by figuring out where you can line up money on either side. You know, the climate change debate, at least in 2009, 2010, when there was a chance of a bill in Congress, Democrats relied on money from the renewable energy industry. There was money to push back against fossil fuel interests. But here for these foreign policy debates, it's really a one-sided debate because, you know, the civilians who could be killed in a bombing campaign, you know, and some of these other stakeholders in this debate, they don't have a voice. They don't have a lobby. They don't have money to influence politics or public opinion. So, you know, in a money-driven system, folks who have the resources, in this case defense contractors, have the loudest voice.
It seems that the only tool to us, available to us right now, is basically to shame the media into some level of transparency. Do I have that right, or are there other remedies? Is this the sort of thing that an FCC regulation, like, you know, some variation on the old fairness doctrine, which is now long gone, or you know, equal time? Is there any administrative or legislative solution for this, or is this purely something that we have to deal with in our corporate media monopolies?
You know, I don't know, Tom. I don't know if there's a regulatory fix to this. Certainly, I think Americans deserve to hear from a variety of viewpoints. No one's saying that these generals should not go on TV at all. They should just at least disclose their conflicts of interest. But the larger problem of not having diversity of viewpoints, not having a pro-peace or a pro-diplomatic solution coming from a pundit or another expert, that's a big problem. And I don't think we have an easy fix to that.
Yeah. I mean, shouldn't there be such voices within the administration, for example? I mean, isn't that one of the major roles of the Department of State? And might they not be able to offer? Of course, then it looks like they're a house divided, I suppose. Yeah. Well, do you know of any politicians who are taking this on?
Taking on the media aspect? No. I don't know any politicians who have reacted to this story or to the similar stories that have been reported in recent years. But I think as many more people pay attention to this issue, we might see some reaction on Capitol Hill. I'll have some follow-up stories in the coming weeks.
I mean, it used to be, you know, Dennis Kucinich was a reliable voice for peace, although he was, you know, largely marginalized by the media. But, you know, it was like, okay, let's listen to our token, you know, peacenik. Here's Dennis. Then it became Rand Paul for a short while, although now he's all in favor of killing everybody. After all, he wants to run for president as a Republican. Are there any, and you know, some very, very sane voices, Barbara Lee, the only person to vote against the Iraq authorization, by and large not listened to. They're just, you know, they don't, you know, it's Sunday, it's Meet the Republicans. You know, they don't get into these kind of shows and things.
No, that's right. If you listen to Democracy Now! Yesterday, they had folks on talking about different sides of this conflict. I haven't heard anywhere else in the corporate media talking about the role of Saudi Arabia in financing ISIS, right, and how do you involve the Kurds? Do the Syrian so-called moderate rebels even want to fight ISIS? Will they just take these weapons and then
They just cut a deal with ISIS day before yesterday, a non-aggression pact.
That's right, they did. One of the largest factions there. So, you know, these issues aren't being discussed in the corporate media, and I don't know of any politician that's really taking up this charge. You know, Tom Harkin, who's retiring, made some interesting comments the other day, but again, he's retiring. He's right on his way out.
Right, and it seems like that's the only time they can be honest, and even then, if they want to do an Eric Cantor and, you know, get a job with an investment bank or a defense firm or a lobbyist that might have them as clients, they just keep their mouths shut, you know, until after it's all over.
I mean, there's perverse incentives here.
Yeah. So, once again, your report is published both in The Nation and Republic Report?
Only The Nation here, but I'll be doing some follow-up at Republic Report and The Nation.
Okay, so you can go over to thenation.com, and the title of the article is Who's Paying the Pro-War Pundits? And this is, you know, genuinely a horrible commentary on the capture of our media and our government in large part, and public opinion, certainly, by these companies that are basically in the business of weapons of death. It's amazing. Lee, you are always one of the finest investigative reporters in this country, and you always bring amazing stories to us. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Tom. Take care.
It's a pleasure and an honor. Lee Fong, you can check out his work over at thenation.com. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's really a sad kind. You know, Dennis Kucinich proposed a Department of Peace at the cabinet level. I'm thinking that was a really smart thing. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. You wanted to talk about
that? How are you doing, Tom?
Good. Republicans and boogeymen?
Yeah, well, here we go. This is one of our great politicians that warned us long ago, beware of the military corporate complex. But the people are having a hard time swallowing this boogeyman. They swallowed the Iraq boogeyman, and now they're really apprehensive about this.
Yeah, I'm with you. Corky, your phone is really, really, really badly breaking up. So, you know, if you want to call back in and make a point, we'll not count this as a call for the week, but you're going to have to get your phone cleaned up. Josh in Algona, Iowa. Hey, Josh, you wanted to talk about the president?
Yeah, hey, Tom. You know, when it comes, you know, to politics, here's my question. Why does the president back himself into a box? And I'll give you two examples. The first example is the red line in Syria. And now when he said, you know, no American troops are going to be on the ground, what's going to happen if all of a sudden we have to have some sort of troops on the ground? He's going to have to walk that statement back, and it just looks bad politically. Why doesn't he just say all options are on the table?
Yeah.
And leave that as
Josh, out of
have to walk it back.
Out of, you know, thousands and thousands of things that the president has said over the last 6 years, you're pulling out two. They were probably not the best thing for him to say at the time, but, you know, and Republicans have turned these into talking points that they're trying to elevate to the point of a religion. Apparently you are too. I'm not so concerned about it, frankly. Rolando in Granada Hills, California. Hey, Rolando, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Thank you, Don. I just want to remind the people about this Christianity thing, you know, the origin of Christianity, and somehow part of the convention that took place after 325 years that Jesus Christ was born, you know, there was a convention in Nicaea in Rome in which they decide that they're going to convert to Christianity for Constantine.
Right.
You have to remember that we have very specific detail, you know, on the way how Julius Caesar died, the people who died, the conspiracy, you know, the people who killed him. And that was 44 years before Jesus Christ. But we don't have in the true history, there was about 100 historians at the time that Jesus Christ. This man that was walking in water, this man that was able to revive the people, in the true history, in the world of these people, historians that exist at the time in different countries, they don't mention anything about this gray man that was walking in water.
What's your point, Rolando? I'm missing it.
My point of view is that my point is that was almost invention of the Roman Empire. You know,
that modern Christianity is an invention.
No. The Jesus Christ, Jesus Christ was almost invention. Perhaps this man exists at the time, but it's not the man that the religion pretend to post to us. You know, that was because the true historians, they didn't record these things, and they record many other things that was with less value at this, you know. This thing, we have to go to the history, real history, in order to...
I don't disagree that there is a debate over if there was a historical Jesus, and if so, who he was and what he was all about. The Book of Thomas is very informational in that. Blaine Pagels and Robert Plunk, I think his first name is Robert, have written some brilliant stuff on this. The Four Gospels, the Five Gospels is a brilliant book on it. Rolando, thanks for the call. We'll be back. Crazy. Okay. Oh my. You know, Mercury's not retrograde yet, but Wayne in Chicago. Hey, Wayne, what's on your mind? You want to talk about Li Fong's article in General Zinni?
Yes, Tom. How are you, sir?
I am well, thank you. I hope you are too.
Yeah, I'm fine. I just wanted to say, people like Li Fong, Greg Palast, Glenn Greenwald, Matt Taibbi, Amy Goodman, these people are just absolutely incredible.
Yep.
With the investigative reporting that they do.
Yep.
And of course, I can't leave out, last but not least, Tom Hartman.
Yeah, but I'm not on the ground doing the investigative reporting. I'm a commentator and I do these shows. But these guys, the names that you named are, these people, you know, they're putting themselves in the front lines. They're doing amazing work.
are. But anyway, I've been wondering about Mr. Zinni for a couple of weeks now because I've been listening to him talk, and he's of the persuasion that, you know, we should send in a couple of brigades, and he keeps saying like, a couple of brigades, that's like 10,000 men, two brigades, 3,000 to 5,000 men in one brigade.
Whoa.
So he keeps saying we wipe out ISIS in weeks. So what I was wondering was, because I was thinking he had an ulterior agenda, because first of all, the Iraqis have 1 million men ready to fight, and I know he knows that. So I was wondering, why would he keep saying America should send in a couple of brigades and we can wipe out ISIS in just a few weeks, with him knowing that the Iraqis have 1 million men ready to fight? So that was the first red flag that went up for me. But now Lee Fong has just confirmed my suspicions. You know, I'm going to go to that article and find out exactly what he's saying about Mr. Zinni. Because Mr. Zinni's really been pushing American troops on the ground.
Yeah.
And, you know, come to find out, I'll find out in the article who he's working for and who's paying him. So.
Yeah. Well, I can read you the paragraph. It says, retired General Anthony Zinni, perhaps the loudest advocate of a large deployment of American soldiers into the region to fight ISIS, is a board member of BAE Systems U.S. subsidiary and also works for several military-focused private equity firms. And he's got links, you know, out to the sources on this. So
yeah, that's it. So yeah. I mean,
it's all about the money.
Say that again.
It's all about the money.
Right. It's all about the money. Now, you know what, Tom? He may actually believe that what he's saying is true, and then again, he may not believe it's true. He may just be doing it for the money, like you're saying.
Yeah.
So that's the bet. And like you were just saying a minute ago, al-Nusra has cut a deal with ISIS for them not to shoot each other. Now, who are we going to give money? What Syrian so-called moderate rebels, who are we going to give money to now?
Yeah.
To fight Assad, as far as these moderate rebels are concerned?
I think, frankly, if we want to have an ally in the region against Syria, or excuse me, against ISIS, it would be Assad. The choices are narrowing by the day, Wayne. And again, this all goes back to George W. Bush opening the gates of hell with one of the most stupid U.S. foreign policy decisions in the history of the United States. And it's not just Pottery Barn. It's Humpty Dumpty. You know, Humpty Dumpty is broken and shattered and can't be put back together again, and the region is going to have to basically be rebuilt from scratch, and it's going to have to be done by locals, and we need to be getting out of the way. Wayne, thanks a lot for the call. Your insights are always brilliant. Jim in Camino Island, Washington. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I'd like to toss a little meme out there for what it's worth. Seems like all our issues these days, Ukraine and ISIS and all that, come down to oil.
Yeah.
And I'd like to propose that we embark on a sort of a combination of Manhattan Project and Apollo program thing to say in 10 years we will use no more than 10% of our economy based on oil, and then in another 10 years, we'll be done with it altogether. Leave it in the ground.
Yeah.
Make it no more influential than, say, pistachios or hand-woven rugs.
Right. Well, and as I point out, you know, if you want a neo-Wahhabist hardcore Muslim group that is robbing, raping, murdering, and pillaging their way through a country, you don't have to look to ISIS. Boko Haram is actually larger and more violent. But,
sure,
you know, they're operating in central and western Nigeria and eastern Nigeria where there's not oil. It's all over on the western side. And now they're moving into Uganda where there's no oil. So, you know, we're not all that concerned about that. But here's what Jimmy Carter had to say about this in 1979. He actually proposed what you're talking about, and he put it into law. Here he is.
The energy crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation. These are facts, and we simply must face them. What I have to say to you now about energy is simple and vitally important. Point one, I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never. Moreover, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
By the year 2000. And we were on course to do it. In fact, we were beating his goals in 1980. This was in 1979. And then at the end of the year, 1980, November of 1980, Ronald Reagan won the election as the Iranians continue to hold the hostages. And Reagan comes into office and he takes Carter's solar panels off the roof and he undoes all that legislation.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
If Ronald Reagan had never stolen the election of 1980, we would not be in the Middle East right now. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program. And pleased to be with you. Wisconsin, Scott Walker having some problems in Wisconsin. Oh, did you see this story? We have this problem, right, of guys with long beards saying convert or die. Phil Robertson said this on Fox News the other day, the Duck Dynasty guy. Convert them to Christianity or kill them all. Right. So we got this problem with these people, convert or die. They also don't believe in teaching evolution in our schools. ISIS. School is starting now in the Middle East. Kids are going back to school, and ISIS is running schools, right? They're trying to be, hey, we're a government, we're doing things. You know, Mosul, for example, one of the second largest city in the country of Iraq, is now controlled by ISIS. They turned the schools back on, sent kids back to school. But they ripped out pictures from the books because this fundamentalist form of Wahhabist Islam doesn't, you know, thinks that the first commandment that says no graven images means no pictures. And they're banning the teaching of Charles Darwin and the theory of evolution. Really? ISIS? Duck Dynasty? ISIS, Tea Party, ISIS, right? These stories kind of write themselves. All you have to do is put the information out. And it's pretty straightforward stuff, really, when you think about it. Rennell in Dacula, Georgia. Am I saying both those words right?
Rennell, yes, is Dacula.
Dacula, okay. Hey, what's up?
Yep. Suburb of Atlanta. So my question and point is, I mean, we're playing whack-a-mole with terrorists, and I'm not sure if we're being disingenuous or what the deal is, but we're saying we're going to fight ISIS, but ISIS is just the flavor of the month. So how do we identify ISIS? How do we identify or distinguish them from Al-Qaeda or from a civilian or from, you know, anything else that's walking around in the Middle East? And I haven't heard that answer right yet, as far as when will we know that we defeated ISIS, that particular threat is over. I don't think that we are being upfront and honest about the strategy, and the strategy should be trying to figure out why these people are joining ISIS and why they feel like this is a better alternative to whatever else they're doing, because until we do that, we're going to be there.
Yeah, and the reason why is because we knocked down a secular government in Iraq, Saddam Hussein, who was protecting Sunnis, Shia, Jews, Christians, Alawites, Yazidis. I mean, you might not have liked him as a dictator. His sons were sexual predators, or at least one of them was, very weird people. But he kept the country stable. Women were going to college. Women were going to medical school. They were teachers, doctors, lawyers. You know, there was a lot to be said for Iraq, given the simmering tensions under the surface that Saddam Hussein was holding in check. We blew that up, and we replaced it with a government that was largely partial to the Shia.
And debating how or why that got blew up is a separate conversation, but we originally went there in response to the 9/11 threats against America.
No, that's the theory about why we went to Afghanistan. We went to Iraq because we were told that Saddam Hussein was an evil man who had weapons of mass destruction that he might use on us.
It's not the same guise of terrorism is what my point is. My point is we are there under the guise of fighting terrorism because terrorism is a universal threat and the extended threat to America. That's the guise of why we're there. And we're saying now that once we defeat ISIS, then that threat is only there. And that's not true. We're either going to be fighting terrorism forever or we're not. And that's what I think we're not being upfront and honest about.
Yeah, I'm with you. And this is why we need to, you know, if we're going to put together a coalition of nations, let's put together a coalition of nations to help some of these states that are on the verge of being failed states, and some of them that functionally are failed states, Afghanistan and Iraq, to put together civil society, to build infrastructure, to build nations that work. And you know, it's crazy. It's the whole thing. I mean, all the way back to George W. Bush in 2001, 2002, 2003. It's just so wrong. Rennell, thank you very much for the call. John in Chicago. Hey, John.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Frank Luntz?
I just wanted to comment. Pardon me?
You said we need a Frank Luntz?
Yeah, that was my thinking. Like, we need to have a Democratic Frank Luntz who would basically be able to come up with wordsmithing the right bumper sticker. Like, for example, share and grow. And I like the terminology, instead of liberal and conservative, which conservatives are not conservative, they're actually regressive, having progressive and regressive. And really wordsmith and put some thought into, like, the words that we use, because I have conservative friends that say, like, oh, you're just liberal. I go, no, I'm progressive. I'm like Teddy Roosevelt. I'm not a liberal, dirty hippie, like, kidding around with them and everything like that. Mm-hmm. I'm a progressive. And they're not really conservative because if they were conservative, they'd be like, hey, this oil's worth a lot of money now. It'll be worth more in the future. Why don't we conserve it for the future when oil's at $200 a barrel, and be able to go and say, we need that for plastic 150 years from now. And let's not use it for burning in cars.
Yeah.
And so I think we need the wordsmith. I just want to get your thought on that premise.
Well, a number of us have tried. There's the guy from the University of California at Berkeley. What's his name? A professor out there who wrote Don't Think of an Elephant. I'm forgetting his name. I wrote a book called Cracking the Code, which is all about political communication. I think it's a little bit more accessible than some of the academic books. Drew Weston has written some good stuff. The Political Brain, he wrote. So, you know, there are some good things out there. But Frank Luntz, the advantage that Frank Luntz and people on his side have is that, and not specifically Frank, but just generally that whole right wing meme machine. And it's much like, you know, this Weinberg group that Mike Papantonio was talking about earlier, is that they don't have a commitment to the truth. They have a commitment to an outcome. And so it's say whatever's necessary, do whatever necessary, distort things. It's like, you know, George Bush's plans to dial back on clean air regulations and allow big polluting companies like Koch Industries to dump more poison in our air. He called that the Clean Air Act, right? You know, the Healthy Skies Initiative,
right.
Excuse me. You know, it's bizarre. You know, it's Orwellish. It's Orwellian.
Yeah, well,
and I don't think there's any Democrats who are capable or willing to do that. There's too much of a commitment on the Democratic side to either just being upfront about it or you know, in some cases like Joe Manchin, just trying to play two sides, but not the whole aggressive, we're going to lie to you thing.
Well, but I mean, like, share and grow. I think that would be, sure, you know, the kind of thing of saying, hey, you know, just something like.
Well, hope and change worked pretty good. It's just that the Republicans got together on January 20th, 2009, and said, how can we stop all the hope and change. And they came up with a plan, and they're still executing that plan to this day. And the caucus room conspiracy continues. And it will continue. And if they get the Senate, boy, is it going to go on steroids. I mean, bad stuff is happening. John, you're right, though. The Democrats need to be messaging better. You know, when they come up with laws like the S-CHIP, right, which is the health insurance program for young people, S-CHIP sounds like, you know, something you avoid when you're walking through a cow paddy, right? It's not like the Patriot Act, you know. It's like the right-wingers are so good at naming legislation. I'm with you. John, thank you for the call. Ken, in Ticonderoga, New York. Hey, Ken, you wanted to talk about the Middle East?
Yeah. Well, I don't want to, but I feel I need to.
Here it is, yeah.
The Middle East is relevant. Why? Because of oil. So let's make it irrelevant by conserving more here instead of spending. The number I heard last week from somebody was they'd thrown away $500 million already on this campaign against ISIS. That $500 million, if you broke it up into grants, like here's the money, insulate your house at an average of $2,500 a house, which is what the average retrofit insulation job costs, that's 200,000 homes.
Right. Right. Which significantly lowers our oil consumption and our
20 to 40% savings on typically fuel oil number two. And if you multiply that multiple times over, leave out the trillions. I'm just talking about the hundreds of millions they're going to commit now,
right,
and put it into our homes instead of bombs in the Middle East.
Right.
We can make the Middle East irrelevant. We got plenty of oil. All we got to do is stop exporting it to Japan, et cetera.
Right.
And let them take care of each other.
Yeah, I don't think most Americans realize that the largest single export of the United States the last 2 years in a row was refined petroleum products, principally gasoline and diesel fuel. I don't think most Americans realize that, and that's going to go up dramatically if the Keystone XL pipeline is completed, because it's all for export. And that's one of the reasons why gas prices are as high as they are in the United States, is because we're selling the cheap oil, we're selling the cheap refined products overseas. And the Koch brothers run one of those refineries, and they're making a fortune on it. Ken, thanks for the call. It's an excellent point. We'll be back. Bob Ney is going to be with us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
In about another 4.5 minutes, Bob Ney. Ney Day! We'll be back with the author of Sideswiped with the Talk Radio News Service. And welcome back, Tom, in Champaign, Illinois, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Very good to speak with you. I have a theory on the strength of our dollar, the U.S. dollar.
Mm-hmm.
Is it backed by our military strength since we don't have any gold? And Libya has gold. Egypt has gold. The Middle East has gold, and they also have oil.
Yeah.
Tom,
we have a lot of gold, and we have a lot of oil. There is still a fair amount of gold in Fort Knox.
What kind of a theory is that?
Yeah. But
shoot holes in it, or?
Here's the problem with a gold standard for a currency, and the reason why there's no country in the world, to the best of my knowledge right now, that's on a gold standard. If you've got, say, $1 trillion worth of gold sitting in Fort Knox, and you have $1 trillion worth of dollars circulating through your economy, then every dollar is backed by a dollar's worth of gold, right? So what happens when your economy grows? You say your economy grows 10%. You now need $1 trillion plus $100 billion in cash, and if you're going to have an extra 10% of dollars to accommodate that larger economy, you're going to have to get 10% more gold. You go out in the world market to buy that gold. It drives the price of the gold up, which drives the value of your currency down. It's a very, very, very messy and dysfunctional system. The only way it worked was when the world decided to peg the price of gold at $35 an ounce. That didn't last very long because that's just completely unsustainable and stupid. And the gold standard is not a system that works, and it's certainly that would work for the United States. What backs the U.S. dollar is what the Constitution refers to as the full faith and credit of the United States. In other words, people know that we are one of the richest countries in the world. We've got $54 trillion of public assets. We've got another, you know, somewhere between $50 and $100 trillion in private assets in the United States. We are a huge economy, a very wealthy country, and that's what backs up our currency. And every other country's currency is basically backed up by their government. And when investors say, okay, we don't trust that currency anymore, that's when, you know, a currency has a crisis. But we are so far from that in the United States, absent a major crash. And even with a major crash, I think what you would see is everybody would be flocking to federal bonds, just like it did in the 30s. Am I making sense, Tom?
Yeah, it's just that, you know, like I feel like we've got so many military bases that it's almost like we're showing how strong the dollar is, you know. And Libya, we want a regime change there because of their gold situation. They have quite a bit of gold. And then the Benghazi stuff happened.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, and they bring it up as on the regular news as being some other type of situation whenever, you know, it's like underneath there's a situation that they don't want to talk about.
Yeah, I don't think it's gold that's driving those things. I think it's oil. I think if the, to quote George Herbert Walker Bush, if the principal product of the Middle East was cabbage, we wouldn't be involved.
Right.
I think I'm quoting Bush, the first, the elder. But it certainly was from that era. And that's the problem. And we have the ability to be completely oil independent. We need to, A, stop exporting refined petroleum products and keep them here, and, B, stop importing crude petroleum products, and then, C, most aggressively, we need to put a price on carbon so that all of the renewables are cheaper than fossil fuels, which is not difficult to do. You know, Ireland's been doing it for a decade and a half. It works just fine. It didn't hurt their economy. It helped their economy. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's check in with Bob Ney, the author of Sideswiped and reporter for the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Congressman, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Tom. How are you?
I am well. What's going on in the world today?
Well, up on Capitol Hill, there's a lot going on, and of course, the Joint Chief of Staff Chairman General Dempsey addressed on the Hill some possibility of U.S. ground forces being involved against the Islamic State, but I just wanted to clarify because, you know, of course, some people will jump on that. He's not saying we're going to use ground troops. He just simply is saying that at some point in time, if there were certain scenarios, you know, you don't know what will happen, and they're... Some are trying to make that, you know, a contrary policy to President Obama. But if one is asked the question, well, you know, in all cases, 100% there will never be ground troops, you don't know. So I don't view that as something that they're going to use to disrupt, you know, anything from the president's proposal. But the House Republicans have their own share of problems, Tom. They've been meeting fast and furiously in closed-door sessions. Some of the Republicans would love for this whole ISIS issue to be placed under the continuing resolution, which will fund the government up to December the 10th, and others want the separate vote on it. Then if it's separated in a vote, you have one vote in the House on the issue, a second vote on continuing the government, because Boehner won't make the mistake he made a year ago of a shutdown. If they go to the Senate, those two proposals could be merged into one, coming back to the House, and then some of the Republicans who voted against it would vote then, most likely, for it, because it would be tied to the resolution to fund the government. So whichever scenario comes out, it looks like there'll be, you know, something for what the president wants on ISIS. The one other thing, which is the unknown, there were some really strange amendments being floated, Tom, and the one I did want to mention is where the Pentagon would be compelled to provide the name of everybody that are the, quote, moderate rebels that we're working with, and a background check, basically, on any ties to terrorism they would have. And then, in turn, that doesn't mean they're excluded from using them. So if you look at that type of amendment, I mean, we can go to recent history where Congressman John Lewis, an icon of the civil rights movement, who was, you know, beaten during marches, was on a no-fly list as, you know, a person that's not supposed to be flying.
Along with Ted Kennedy.
Yeah, and Ted Kennedy, and it took a long time to get him off of those lists. So if we're going to rely on that, one would say, why are they doing it? And the insidious part to this, if it were to become part of the package, which I doubt, would be that if one person was not properly screened, guess who would be at fault? The Obama administration.
Sure.
So a lot of bad politics, bad policy in that type of deal.
Yeah, there you go.
In it. And then the big news of the day, there was 3,000-some troops headed to Africa for the Ebola crisis. There's about $500 million in humanitarian money which will go into Africa and Iraq to help for humanitarian purposes, and that comes from a contingency fund that's been around. It's an overseas contingency operations, and it's helped to fund things such as the, you know, war in Afghanistan.
This has got to be scarier than hell for those soldiers. Are they asking for volunteers, or is this just, hey, you're in the Army, buddy, into the middle of the Ebola zone?
Oh, from what I understand, they'll be called up. Yeah, they won't be. From what I understand, it's not a volunteer issue. It's there.
Right.
It kind of raises the question of, you know, what about a UN program? We have five countries now that have the Ebola targeted in them. And I know that exponentially it's going to multiply. But one would think you could find, say, let's say 400-some people in each country, and they're going to deliver home health care kits, hundreds of thousands of them, and set up some, you know, temporary hospital facilities, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
You would think we could find something through the UN where we could find, let's say, 400 people per country. We could, you know, pay for the operation, maybe send some troops and other countries come into it. And that's kind of what the Washington Press Corps is starting to look at. You know, where did this come from? It was sort of something that I think caught everybody a little bit off guard.
Yeah.
Not saying that it's not a crisis, you know, but the fact of how the 3,000-some troops are going down there, and there needs to be an issue settled of...
Yeah, should this be military troops, or should it be Peace Corps folks? I mean, you know, it's people who have some training in dealing with local cultures and providing medical services. And
well, that's what shocked me about it. I mean, there are other people who are more trained, not to say we don't have wonderful military people, but not particularly trained in this type of situation. So surely through the World Health Organization, the United Nations, we could have found a couple of thousand people, you know, that we would pay the money, they'll be able to go down. So that the announcement came so quick.
Yeah.
Like I said, it caught people off guard. The one other story, too, that I wanted to mention, and I don't know if you've talked about it today because I didn't get a chance to listen. I was doing some other stations, but the Foley family is starting to talk about the fact of, you know, our policies, which I don't think a lot of people knew, is that, you know, when this happens with terrorists, they were on their own to find out whether their families were involved. Our intelligence agencies basically gave them no help, kind of side-warned them that raising private dollars could be a crime, told them they probably wouldn't be charged, versus what was done overseas where the intel forces in five other countries actually started to communicate back with experts to the terrorists. And whether one's negotiating or not, and whether we pay ransom or not, which we don't, the fact remains that the intelligence agencies, according to what the families are saying, were of absolutely zero help or compassion to the families. And I think that's the main point of the story.
Well, it's one of those greater good issues. I mean, you know, at what point do you compromise what's best for the nation to save, you know, a couple of individuals?
Sure.
And these are not the kind of days I'd want to be president of the United States.
Right. And we can't pay the ransoms, but maybe in the future the agencies can explain more, you know, work a little bit more with the families, the intel agencies.
Yeah.
Intel agencies probably aren't necessarily equipped to directly do this kind of thing, and that's kind of understandable. So the story raised, you know, some issues of that nature.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a busy day. We'll see what's ahead with the Republicans maneuvering this proposal. They've only got about 4 or 5 days, and they're all out of there. And, of course, this will mark the 14th, if I'm correct, the 14th year of temporary resolutions.
Continuing resolutions.
Yes, sir.
Amazing. Amazing. Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, author of Sideswiped. Thank you, Bob.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And in Scotland on Thursday, that's tomorrow? No, day after tomorrow. Today's Tuesday. Yeah. Scotland, I never know what day of the week it is. In Scotland, I believe it's on Thursday, they're holding a national referendum, a vote, on whether they should separate from the United Kingdom and be their own country. And John Nichols is over there from Edinburgh, Scotland, reporting on this for The Nation. He's the Washington correspondent for The Nation. TheNation.com is the website. Hey, John, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Tom, it's great to be on with you. I hope our connection is good.
Yeah, it's just fine. It's just fine. So what's your sense of what's going on over there?
Well, it's something huge, Tom. In fact, if there wasn't so much going on in the States, I would have made you come with me. This is everything that you've been talking about and that you've been fascinated by for so many years. Scotland is in the midst of a great debate about self-determination, about whether they will govern their own affairs or be governed from London. Now, people can take different stands on that issue, but I cannot emphasize to you, I have covered elections all over the world. I've covered all sorts of politics in all sorts of settings. I've never been someplace where democracy was so fully engaged. You can't walk down the street. You cannot go into a shop. You can't go anywhere where people aren't having deep, serious debates about the future of their country and the future of their lives. It's a pretty remarkable thing.
It's been 300 years in the coming, though.
Yes, it has been. And there are no guarantees that it will result in an independent state. The polls show that it's razor thin. There's been an intense campaign, but it is so very different from in the United States. People really should be paying attention to this.
Yeah.
If you can imagine it, Tom, voter registration is at 97%.
And they don't, unlike Australia, they don't have required voter registration.
This is voluntary. And they have already had something like, in a country where there are 4.2 million voters, they have already had something like 700,000 cast postal ballots. So there's just an intense level of engagement here. There is talk that turnout could be 85, 87%. They have done some remarkable things, all of which go to sort of the most idealistic discussions in the United States about democracy. They have expanded the electorate, including 16 and 17-year-olds, on the argument that this is their future that's being voted on. They have had an incredible level of debates, regular debates on television, but also in town halls across Scotland. They have had a massive mobilization for people to come and vote. And beyond that, they've had this intensive discussion about the future, about whether a small country is better able to govern itself and better able to function, how they would relate to other countries, but also about austerity. And I would emphasize to you that if you want to understand what this Scottish referendum is about, it is about a sense on the part of a great many Scots that if they governed their own affairs, they would not have to buy into the austerity politics, cuts and assaults on unions, other issues that we've talked about so often that you see in the United States and in Britain.
Yeah. You know, Paul Krugman wrote insightful column a few weeks ago, or maybe it was last week, in which he pointed out that if Scotland separates from the UK, but they continue to use the British pound as their currency, they're going to find themselves in the same awful position that Greece and Spain and Portugal and Ireland find themselves in with regard to the EU. They will not have control over their economic future, or at least their financial future, and that could be a real disaster. Is there much conversation about coming up with a separate Scottish currency, or is the broad consensus, yeah, we'll become independent, but we'll continue to use the pound?
There's a great discussion about everything being up for grabs, and potentially about using the pound, but also potentially about using the euro. And one thing to understand, Tom, and I have great respect for Paul Krugman. I have some challenge to his column. I agree with Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, who has argued that the opposite of Krugman and said that Scotland is in an incredibly good position to set up a system, an economic system, where they can avoid austerity. Now, you are right to bring up the currency issues. One thing to understand, however, is that Scotland is a much wealthier country by many, many measures, at least proportionally, to some of the other places that you've mentioned. And so as a result, if they have control of their own affairs, they have the potential, not the certainty, because you're right about all the complexities of a global economy, but they have the potential to steer their way through this. And the truth of the matter is that the discussion here in Scotland is exactly about issues like that. It's very, very serious. When you walk down the street, when you go to a meeting, and I was at a remarkable meeting last night, a couple of them with Tariq Ali, the great campaigner from Britain, originally from Pakistan, who was up here for this, saying it's the most engaged, small-D democratic experience he's had in many years. The discussions go deep. They're very, very serious. And they go to the heart of a bigger question, Tom. And that is, in a globalized economy where you have very, very big countries that seem to be surprisingly dysfunctional, surprisingly incapable of governing themselves, and always in sort of a stuck in the middle situation without being able to go one way or the other, Scotland doesn't want to be that, or at least a lot of Scots don't want to be that. They actually want to have a country that is forward-looking, that is progressive. What they say, what the Scots who favor independence say, is they want a fairer, more modern Scotland. And they believe that as a small country, they can do that. When they look for a model, they look to places like Norway rather than buying into the notion that they would have to necessarily be an economic basket case or be in some sort of difficult situation.
Right. What's your sense of which way this is going to go?
Boy, it's the worst thing in the world to be an American journalist telling people what's going to happen on the ground in their country. And so I get asked that all the time here, which is quite funny.
Well, what are the pundits there saying?
Well, the pundits here think it's an even split. I think that there is, if you had to bet money, there's probably a marginal sense that it might go no. Remember, declaring independence via the ballot is a pretty big deal. It's something that happens rarely. And so even with all of the excitement about it, there's certainly a lot of people that are skeptical. David Cameron, the British Prime Minister, has been here aggressively campaigning, begging, right, effectively begging, right, the Scots to stay in the United Kingdom. So I think it will be very, very close. But I can tell you that if it fails even narrowly, this will change the politics, not just of Scotland, but of Britain. This is
well. What's I'm curious. We just have a minute left, John. I'm curious what this is doing to Northern Ireland and Wales, to other traditionally independent countries.
Well, they're very different, obviously, but the Welsh are watching this incredibly closely. They have been here. Welsh nationalists have been in Scotland, and are very interested in what happens. What I can tell you is this. If Scotland does vote yes, and that is certainly a possibility if you look at the polls, then Wales will immediately ask for a much greater level of autonomy. And that is not just the Welsh nationalists, but even the Welsh Labour Party will become very aggressive in that demand, and they'll probably get it. One thing to understand is this has shaken Britain to its roots. I mean, all of the leaders of Britain have canceled other activities. They've come en masse to Scotland to beg Scotland to stay. And certainly, if Scotland votes to go, they're going to be very, very determined to try and keep Northern Ireland and Wales as a part of the United Kingdom, or as a part of Great Britain.
Right. Fascinating stuff. John Nichols, live from Edinburgh, Scotland, Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine, thenation.com. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Tom. I'm glad we're talking about this.
And me too. Keep up the great reporting.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And travel safely. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes past the hour. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Norma watching Free Speech TV in Montgomery, Alabama. Hey, Norman, you are on the air. What's up?
Hi, Dr. Tom. Earlier, I had switched to CNN to see if I could see anything on the damage in the hurricane in California. And instead, what I saw was Newt Gingrich talking about ISIS. The person interviewing him was asking him, would this be a 10 or 15-year war? And he said, no, that what we are going to have to do, the United States will have to do, is hire, pay, and train people from all of these countries around the world that have Islamic terrorists in their countries to fight it in their own countries, and we should be prepared for a 50-year effort.
That's pathetic. It's, you know, trying to fight an ideology with dollars is absolutely bass-ackwards. It's the wrong way to do it. I mean, if we want to fight these ideologies, the way to do it is to build schools for girls, encourage civil society, provide them with jobs and infrastructure. Then, you know, people...
Why is he trying to teach the public to be prepared for a 50-year war?
Well, because he's a Republican. I mean, you know, this is the gravy train for the military-industrial complex. And increasingly, they're not able to sell their stuff to police departments around the country. Do you see where 20 school districts now have mine-resistant vehicles and assault rifles that have been given to them by the military? Los Angeles Unified School District.
I'm in Alabama. This is common.
Yeah, I mean, it's downright bizarre. And there's a lot of pushback to that. And people are saying, okay, we don't want the military-industrial complex arming our police. We don't want them arming our teachers. And so they're going to say, well, you know, we got to sell our stuff someplace, so let's have a nice war in the Middle East. We need to get out of the business of war. We need to stop having an economy that depends on war. And
well, Dr. Tom, don't we have some kind of international law that guarantees civil liberty for everybody? And isn't the World Court supposed to be monitoring this sort of stuff?
Yes, and it's called the United Nations Charter. The problem is that the United Nations is a very, very toothless giant.
Well, why don't we give the United Nations some teeth and get out of it ourselves?
Because the Republicans will not allow that. Remember John Bolton's famous quote about he'd like to blow the top 10 floors off the UN? And then George Bush made him UN ambassador. Republicans, all the way back to the early 50s when the UN was created, or late 40s, whenever it was, I think it was the early 50s, Uthant and then Dag Hammarskjöld, the first two secretary generals. All the way back to there, Republicans have been screaming that our signing these UN treaties that basically prevent us from going to war with other countries unless we're under attack are violations of our sovereignty. And they got no problem with trade deals that are even worse for our sovereignty. But an international agency devoted to peace? No, we can't have that.
So. Well, yeah, I know that, the thought of a 50-year war, you know, how much will that drain the United States to nothing and turn us into a poverty country?
Yeah.
But then, too, when you think about all the countries in which Muslim religion has spread, is there any way to get an international law that would, you know, we have separation of church and state. You went over that yesterday. Okay. Is there any way to get an international law that no country can make their religious laws the law of their country?
No, you're not going to be able to impose that on other nations. That said, we need to be really careful that we continue to do that here in the United States. Norma, thank you for the call. It's a big, complex world out there, and there's a lot of very strange things and people going on. We'll be right back. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Chris in Santa Fe, New Mexico, listening to KTRC. I did not realize tomorrow was Constitution Day. Is that the case?
It sure is, Tom.
Tell me about it.
Tomorrow, September 17th, is the anniversary of the ratification of the Constitution in 1787. It's actually recognized by the federal government as a requirement for all schools that receive federal funds to celebrate on that day and to have educational programming targeted at fifth graders to talk about the Constitution and talk about citizenship. And here in New Mexico, the State Bar of New Mexico has taken it on as a project, and volunteer lawyers like myself have volunteered to go to classrooms around the state and teach the Constitution and provide each student with a pocket copy of the Constitution itself.
Hmm. That's great. That's great. Is there an agency or a group that is sponsoring this?
Well, here in New Mexico, it's been taken on as a project by the State Bar of New Mexico. I'm not sure how it's done in other states, but it is a federal requirement. Most recently, as I understand it, it was part of the Omnibus Reconciliation Budget Act of 2004, I believe, and the late Senator Byrd from West Virginia, who, as you know, was a very stout
He was a fanatic
of the Constitution and teaching the Constitution during his long, long tenure in the Senate. Sponsored that bill. And it's been going on in various forms for quite a long time, a Citizenship Day or Constitution Day. But tomorrow is the day that we celebrate, and I know your listeners, many of them are very, very interested in constitutional issues.
Yeah, yeah. Fascinating. Chris, thanks for the heads up on that. I appreciate it. Hack in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hey, Hack, what's up?
Oh, actually, if the Scots want to stick it to the Brits, I have a proposition for the name of their currency.
Okay.
The Wallace.
Oh yeah, yeah. Was that the character that Mel Gibson played?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
You call it the or if they really really wanted to stick it to him, you know, Sean Connery is a Scot.
Yeah. Oh no, I thought he was Welsh.
No, I think he's Scottish, but name it the Bond.
There you go, or the Connery. Okay, Hack. Thanks a lot.
There you go.
Thanks a lot for the suggestions. Michael in Denver. Hey, Michael, what's up?
All right. Well, I don't know what you have to do. Maybe I can't do anything.
Michael in Denver, you are on the air. No, he's not listening to his phone. Say what? Okay. Ivan in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Ivan, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, my brother. Hey.
What's up?
What leverage do we have in the Middle East? Other than oil, we supply weapons to everybody in the Middle East.
Yep, and then we wonder why they're always fighting.
And instead of going on with this racket of war, we need a new foreign policy. And the plan I like is the one I call the soup Nazi, no weapons for you approach. everybody loves to throw around the Nazi term.
Yeah, yeah.
Seriously.
Yeah, and anybody who's watched Seinfeld knows what you're talking about. No weapons for you, buddy. See, I think it goes deeper than that. We need to fundamentally reform our economy so that such a large chunk of our economy is not based on the military-industrial complex.
Exactly. And all these all those leaders, the Saudi leaders, Yemen leaders, they're all paranoid. They all need weapons.
Yeah, well, and justifiably paranoid because most of them are despots. So
there you go.
Yeah,
there
I have an go. Excellent point. Thanks a lot for the call. Charles in Johnson City, Tennessee, you wanted to talk about the long war?
Yes, and it's very good to speak with you. It's my first time I've ever called.
Well, thank you, Charles.
Yeah, and I was referring back to the lady that called in with the 50-year war predicted by Newt Gingrich.
Right.
Some time ago, Andrew Bacevich wrote an article, The Longest War, and I think he may also have a book, The Longest War.
Mm-hmm.
But he predicted, and not on the same type of manner that Gingrich is talking about, that if we do not watch it, we could get into an 80-year war in the Middle East,
sure.
That we were headed that way, and it was time to end it then and get out.
Yeah.
So Bacevich, generally, I've always found and that he knows what he's talking about and have respected him. a lot more than Newt Gingrich. So,
yeah, we
it is something that to consider. You know, this goes on, and like you say, I really like that. No arms for you. If we keep putting the arms in there, eventually it has to end.
We need to, on the one hand, this is a very difficult balancing act. On the one hand, we very much need to let, this is a regional conflict, we need to let the region sort it out. And there are some substantial regional players, like the Saudis, who have a huge air force, a huge military, and could easily do anything that we could do in that region and do it with more credibility because they're actually Arabs and they're mostly Sunnis. But they're unwilling to do it. And, you know, the UAE, the Qataris, the, you know, right on down the list, these principally Sunni countries are you know, they want us to do their dirty work for them or what, you know, whatever you want to call that work. And it's just it's dysfunctional. It's bad. It's wrong. And I don't know how much longer the American people are going to put up with being played as suckers, basically, by these tin pot dictators.
That's the amazing part. It doesn't take a whole lot to do that.
Right.
It's just like it's back to the original George Bush's invasion.
Yeah, well, Bin Laden said, all I have to do is send two Al-Qaeda guys to the farthest distance in the east and wave a flag with Al-Qaeda written on it, and George Bush will spend millions of dollars stumbling all over himself to get there. You know, it's his plan to bleed America dry. We're now $3-4 trillion in the hole as a consequence of Bush's stupid and unnecessary wars because he reacted the wrong way to what Bin Laden did. Charles, thank you for the call. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be there in Johnson City, Tennessee. We'll be back. It's 28 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Chuck Hagel was just testifying before Congress, said, wouldn't be a good idea if you guys don't vote on this thing so we can look like we've got some legitimacy. Gee, you think? Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Wow. What a week. It seems like such a consequential time in the history of this country. I mean, we're literally dealing with issues of whether democracy is going to survive in the face of oligarchy. You've got the Koch brothers and the Walton family and Shelley Adelson and a few other right-wing billionaires, Pete Peterson, really fighting pretty hard for control over our government. You've got, you know, every single Republican who was a member of the freshman class the last election, every single freshly elected Republican denying that climate change is even real or human cause. I mean, basically denying science. And the only reason that they would do that is money. I mean, it's not like, you know, with some people, you know, who want to, for example, deny women access to birth control, you say, well, you know, the guy's a Catholic. He was raised this way. He's been, you know, taught this all his life. He doesn't want to go to hell. He doesn't, you know. But denying climate change, that's money. That's like the guys who were denying that tobacco caused cancer. I mean, in many cases, it's the same scientists. It's the same think tanks. It's the same groups. So we're at this real crossroads point in American history. I think it's a really important point. It's a very significant inflection point for us. And, you know, we'll see where we go with this. But it's an important time to be paying attention and to be participating. It is not a good time to just sit back and say, eh, let's watch football. Tom, nothing wrong with watching football, but, you know, it's got to be politically active as well. Tom in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, Tom, you just finished reading Wendy Davis's book?
Yeah, Forgetting to Be Afraid, and it's left me feeling really positive. I think she's got a really good chance of winning the gubernatorial race in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And she just sets a really good example. She doesn't speak disparagingly of anyone in her book. And at the very end of her book, she focuses on her filibuster of SB5. And she talks about how she was not
allow the decorum and the deference that the history of the Texas Senate had traditionally allowed its members. And she talks about how all the Democrats' microphones are turned off. She talks about the time stamp on the vote. And if Texas goes blue, what do you think is going to happen to the Republican Party?
I think over time, I think one of two things is going to happen to the Republican Party over the next generation, over the next 20 years. Either it's going to be seen for what it is, completely discredited, and go the way of the Whigs. And something else, you know, another party on behalf of the rich and famous will emerge to replace it. Or they're going to succeed in because of the Supreme Court having set up this oligarchic status for billionaires in terms of politics and whatnot. Or they're going to succeed, and we're going to see America become more and more authoritarian, more and more like Singapore, more and more like Hong Kong, and it'll resemble anything that Americans historically have thought of as America less and less. And you'll see more and more of the cartoonish America. There was a writer back in the 1920s who famously pointed out that a republic or a country was about to fall when its culture became a caricature of itself. And so, we'll see lots and lots of Mickey Mouse and Uncle Sam and coonskin caps and all kinds of talk about freedom and this and that and the other thing, but it'll all be a charade. And, to a large extent, that's the Republican Party right now and what's going on. But, I really think that we're at one of those turning points. And I believe, and this is why I wrote the book, The Crash of 2016, I believe in the next couple of years we're going to see an economic disaster that is going to presage that. And the thing we have to keep in mind, particularly as we're debating the crash the election of 2016, and one of the reasons why I refuse to participate in the circular firing squad about Hillary Clinton or anybody else, is that when the crash of 1929 happened, as we went into the early 30s, we had Franklin Roosevelt elected as our president in 1932. Germany in 1933 got Adolf Hitler as their chancellor. And both countries were being hit by the Great Depression in a very similar fashion. And we chose very different ways to react to it. And I'm very concerned. I'm not saying that there's any Hitlers out there, but these right-wing policies, these corporatist policies, these what history would call fascistic policies that the Republican Party is so fond of embracing, I think could be really, really, truly dangerous, already are dangerous, but in a time of crisis, seriously dangerous for this country. And that's why it's so important that we participate in this election this November and in the one 2 years from this November, which is going to be a big consequential election. Tom, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for the comments on Wendy Davis's book. I've been curious about that. I'm going to have to dig out a copy of it. Mike in Chicago. Hey, Mike.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. You wanted to find conservatives?
Yeah. I wanted to kind of tie this all in with a lot of conversation that you've had today and even last week. Now, I want to open up by saying I respect your desire on how and when you try to show how to debate a conservative.
But
with you, but there's also the people that have called in and they have Godwin's law, by the way, is what I think you were trying to think of, with their frustrations with the Republicans.
Oh.
And I think that
Godwin's law is the one whoever mentions Hitler first loses the argument.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for reminding me.
The thing is, they're frustrated at the, I believe, the politicians, and I think that's the wrong place to start with. What they really do need to deal with are the actual conservative voters, and those are the ones that we need to change how they approach the voting booth, because they're these are the things that they're the ones who are putting these people back in office.
Yeah.
But I'm finding that it's very hard to have discussions with these hardcore conservatives, because I think you can agree with me that a liberal tends to look at the data and information and then come to a conclusion, where conservatives come to a conclusion and then look for the data to fit it.
Right. Let me take this a step larger, Mike. Here's how consultants here in Washington, D.C. talk about this. They view voters as basically consumers of political propaganda. And, you know, you say you want to blame the conservative voter. It's sort of like saying, you know, Clairol is not necessarily the very best shampoo in the world, but look at all these people who buy it. Let's blame them. You know, Dove isn't the best soap in the world, but let's blame all these people. Kellogg's doesn't necessarily make the best cereal, but look at all the, and in fact, look at all the sugar in their things. You know, it's ruining kids' teeth. Let's blame the people who are buying it. No, it's the companies buying the advertising. Advertising actually works. It's why it's a multi-billion dollar industry. And so it's the conservative meme machine, the conservative spinmeisters who are spending hundreds of billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars to influence our politics from scrubbing Wikipedia, which I was talking about earlier, all of their influence there, to paying people to be paid trolls on message boards, to running constant ads and supporting marginal and even, well, not marginal politicians, the Scott Walkers, Rick Scotts of the world. This is where the problem is. And this problem was created by our Supreme Court pulling totally out of their backside this idea that money is somehow protected by the First Amendment, when the spending of money is something we've regulated in this country from the very beginning. You know, if you spend money on drugs, you spend money on prostitution, you spend money on bribery, you go to jail. But if you spend money to, anyhow, I'm on a rant here. Mike, back to you.
Yeah, you're actually leading into what I was trying to come to the conclusion is. When, yeah, you have the advertising and you have all this information out there, that in order to understand this or disseminate this information, one needs to be educated. And then we get back to the one point you brought about being able to suppress this ideology in the Mideast and stuff, is education. And though you were focusing just on women being educated there, I think education in general here. And I think that's what's really been hurting our country, is how our education, our schools, how things have been subtracted from our curriculum. I mean, U.S. history has been changed and altered. Elements are left out. And I think there's so much more that people need to know. And I think educating the education of the conservative voter would help them understand. And I know this is not to attack your guest from last week, but Scotty, when you mentioned to her about the hostage crisis and how Reagan actually interfered with it, or people interfered, I saw the look of surprise. You took her really off guard. She did not even know about that. And you said, well, we have different sources. Well, if she reads that source, will it change her mind about the election? Because she's still insisting that Carter would have lost anyway.
Yeah.
So I'm curious. How do you what kind of education can you get into these conservative people to make them understand that, okay, this is what you want to believe,
right?
This is the truth. Can you actually separate?
Well, here's the other big issue that's causing that, and that is this enormous media consolidation, Mike. And this, again, goes back to Reaganomics. Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act. We used to be, in any town in America, you had 8 or 10 radio stations and TV stations and a couple of newspapers, and they were all owned by different people. Now they're all owned by one or two companies nationwide. And so there's a homogeneity of voices.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We need to aggressively, seriously roll back Reaganomics. The damage that man and his policies did to this country is mind-boggling. And welcome back, Mark, in Rockport, Texas, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Mark, thanks for watching Free Speech. What's up?
Yes, sir, Tom Hartman. I'm a veteran from the Cold War in the 1950s, where I was working on B-52s, hydraulic system. They were loaded down with thermonuclear weapons.
Whoa.
That's not what I want to talk about. I just wanted to tell the lady, we are an empire. We're not a country of mine. We took over from Britain.
Yep.
I know you know what happens to all empires in history.
Yeah, they eventually collapse.
It collapsed.
Sometimes it's messy and sometimes it's not so messy. The UK was successful in collapsing in a way that wasn't so messy.
Right, because the United States, after the Second World War, went and took over in the Pacific.
Yeah, we backstopped.
You
sure.
Right.
Everything from Lend-Lease right through the through the Marshall Act, Marshall Plan, yeah.
Exactly. And the French, too. We got into Vietnam, and that was all. And you know that was all a bald-faced lie, the Gulf of Tonkin. Those destroyers were never fired on. The Maddox and the Sea Turn of Joy.
Yep.
I remember the names of them. Yep. Lies, lies, lies. I can see McNamara standing up there telling the American people that about all this stuff that happened. And that captain on one of the, I think it was the Maddox, he didn't want to go along with that, but he had to.
Right.
You know how that is, you know.
Yeah.
And I just see all this coming down. And, you know, I was in Turkey. I was stationed there for 2 years back in the 50s. And I talked to many, many people from Iraq and from Yemen. And those are good people over there. They're human beings, just like us. They're good people. And what happened with this first Gulf War, that was the catalyst for 9/11. We had been plundering those countries for years and years, setting up the dictatorship in 1953. And y'all were talking about the hostages taken by Iran, you know, because we've been demonizing Iran as long as I can remember. They took those hostages because all they wanted was to get the Shah back so they could put him on trial. But most of the American people don't even know that. And they turned him loose, you know, when Reagan came in. You know, I could go on and on. I wish I could read one little thing here. Wars throughout history have been waged for conquest and plunder. That is war in a nutshell. The master class has always declared the wars, and the subject class has always fought them.
Is that Smedley Butler?
This was by Eugene V. Debs.
Oh, Eugene Debs, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and you probably heard this before.
Oh, yeah.
And which it's all about...
Yeah, you want the sequel to that, read Smedley Butler's book, War as a Racket.
Yeah, right. I've read a lot of stuff, and I have a lot in my head. I've seen, you know, when I speak to people sometime, you know, not just say Republicans, but people that just believe that everything the United States does is immaculate.
Yeah.
Everything, we're right.
Well, and you're also, Mark, you're also old enough to remember what America was like before Reaganomics, when, you know, basically good jobs were to be had and education was cheap and you know, not to sound too much like back in the old days, but, you know, life was good. Mark,
there you go again.
Yeah. Mark, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Before the hour, welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you, and John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, John, you wanted to talk about whales? You have a friend in who's Welsh?
Well, not a friend. It was somebody I met who was with the Socialist Alternative Party, and he said that, well, first of all, Scotland is usually much more left-leaning than the southern part of the country, and there is a standing kind of antipathy between the north and the south, but also he said that the oil revenues wouldn't flow down to Westminster, but you know, would stay in Scotland, and you know, and so in many ways they would be a lot like Norway, because there would be 4 or 5 million people receiving that oil revenue, and you know, they would, you know, I think some people do think that they would do a lot better than bailing out the rest of the country, which...
So, John, is this all about oil? Is the North Sea oil that has been such a boon to the British economy over the last couple of generations? It's all off the coast of Scotland?
I heard this from... You know, I also heard this morning on Minnesota Public Radio from the BBC, and, you know, they did say that that would benefit Scotland if they could hold on to those revenues, and that's why some people do, you know, want to vote yes and separate. That,
right.
You know, it's it has an economic you know, basis that of, you know, why that they want to separate from the rest of the UK, and you know, so he repeated the same thing that I heard you know, in a conversation from somebody who is Welsh, but is a very much of a left-leaning political
right.
person. So, you know, they did have an axe to grind, I think, with the Labour.
Well, I think Wales and Scotland are both broadly to the left of England.
Yeah,
I'm not sure about Northern
and,
Ireland. I think Northern Ireland's pretty conservative.
Yeah, the Welsh nationalists, you know, they really do dislike the English, you know, intensely. And I know it's difficult to wrap your mind around it, but I was in Wales, and they have, especially Northern Wales, they have their own customs, they have their own language, and you know, they've been, you know, in a sense, victimized, you know, throughout history.
I'm very familiar with it. My mother, one of the things she would make bitter jokes about her whole entire life was mm-hmm. that one of her great-great-great-great-great-great ancestors, she was very into genealogy, was the Prince of Wales, when it was Welsh, and that title
right.
was usurped by the House of Stuart, and she was PO'd about it her whole life.
Yeah, and you know, the British have dominated, you know, Wales, Cornwall,
yeah.
North of the country for years and years. It's a very much a very class, you know, ridden society and a very elitist one. And often, you know, those people come from the south,
mm-hmm.
dominate the politics of that country,
yeah.
and people are tired of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I get it. It's going to be real interesting. We'll continue this conversation on Thursday or Friday as the vote comes in. John, thanks for calling and weighing in. Interesting comment. Joe in Falls Church, Virginia. Hey, Joe.
Hi, Tom. Just a quick question. From time to time, I hear you mention a book that talks about all the defense contractors in the Washington area and the mansions that they have. I just wanted to know what was the title of that book and, you know, who was the author.
Thomas Frank wrote a book about that. In fact, if you go on his website, he's got a video of him driving around in those neighborhoods and then getting stopped by the private police. Thomas Frank, who wrote What's the Matter with Kansas, it's the sequel to that book. I forget the title of it. But there have been a number of books on this. The piece that we were talking about today with Lee Fong is over at TheNation.com, who's paying the pro-war pundits. You know, there's a fair amount of documentation. And didn't Michael Moore make a movie about that?
I don't remember.
Yeah, maybe not. Maybe it was some time ago. But
sure.
But there's no shortage of information. It's out there, Joe. It's easy to find. Thanks a lot for the call. Mike in Palmer, Alaska. Hey, Mike, or is that Arkansas? It says AK.
It's Alaska.
Alaska, okay. So what's up?
Hey, I'm a second time caller.
Thank you, Mike.
I was actually in an establishment the other night, and a guy had a T-shirt on that said, "America, if you're not outraged, you're not paying attention." And then on the flip side, on the back side, it said, "Are the Republicans to blame?" And I don't think it's just the Republicans. I think it is the lure of easy money. And the profit margin.
But Americans don't have access to easy money. Americans are working harder than they ever have, and they're making less than they have in two generations.
Only the elite have the access to become, say, if you become a lobbyist,
right.
then 20 years later, what are you going to be doing for a living?
Yeah.
You're going to be trying to sell weapons to countries to make profit for your corporation
yeah.
that you're working for.
Yeah.
So it's like, how do we wake people up?
Well, I think there's a variety of ways to do it. And you know, talking about these issues, that's my job here on the radio every day is talking about these issues. Mike, thanks for the call. Excellent thought-provoking point. John, in Deming, New Mexico, you wanted to talk about the U.S. bombing Syria?
I had a what if. What if, say, the Russians and the Iranians, whoever represent, I know Lavrov, and I don't know who represents Iran, were to approach Assad, and then they were to offer to assist them within the Syrian borders, ground troops, special forces, air support, and they would help Assad take out ISIS within the Syrian borders, and then that would kind of put up, you know, a wall for
It's not going to work, John. The situation is much more complex than that, and Russia has political alliances, diplomatic alliances with both Iran and Syria, which we lack at the moment. So it's a much stickier wicket than that. Thanks a lot for the call, though. It would be great if we could just come up with a simple solution. But, you know, Bush has screwed this thing up so badly, there's no simple solutions left. It's just a disaster, 16 ways to Sunday. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get ready to show up for this coming election. It's a BFD, as Joe Biden would say. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.